breath, Michael told them, for Emma had not yet heard the story about crawling into the chamber with the skeleton, how he'd realized the inscription in the tunnel was a riddle, how he'd drunk from all three jars and had suddenly known where the chronicle was hidden.
"That's what you were doing in there," Emma punched him in the arm. "That was so stupid. Don't ever do anything like that ever again, you hear me? Ever!"
"Okay,
you'd better not,"
and she hit him again for good measure. Michael rubbed his arm and, despite himself, smiled.
"What do you mean you know where the book is hidden?" Gabriel asked. "You had a vision?"
"Not exactly. It was like I remembered where it was, like I'd been the one to hide it. That probably sounds crazy."
"Yes,"
Emma said.
"No," Gabriel said. "Such a thing is common in the magical world. The dead man somehow placed his memories into those potions, and they were transferred to you."
"But I see it all in pieces," Michael said, "and I can't point to anything on a map."
"Be that as it may, the pilot needs a heading. Where should I tell him to go?"
Without thinking, Michael said,
"South. Tell him to go south."
"There is nothing south of Malpessa."
"Yes, there is," Michael said. "There's one thing."
And Gabriel looked at him, nodded, and crept forward to tell the pilot. Michael burrowed down inside his blanket, letting himself feel the buffeting and rocking of the plane. Gabriel returned and said that they had enough gas to reach an outpost on the Ron ice shelf on the coast of Antarctica. Once there, they could refuel, get clothes for the children, and plot the rest of their course. The journey to the outpost would take most of the night.
"Your sister is right to sleep."
And Michael glanced over and saw that Emma's head was on his shoulder and her eyes were closed. When Michael turned back, Gabriel was studying his face, and he knew that the man was gauging his strength for what lay ahead.
"I'll be okay," Michael said. "I'm just tired."
But his voice sounded so feeble that even he didn't believe it. Gabriel put his hand on Michael's arm. It was a strangely gentle and eloquent gesture. Then Gabriel went forward to the cockpit, and Michael rested his head against the humming wall of the airplane as Emma shifted about. He glanced out the window, but all was dark. They were headed south, to the bottom of the world. He closed his eyes. It was a long time before he drifted off to sleep. Michael dreamed of snow. He dreamed of fields and valleys, plains and mountains, all covered in snow and stretching to the horizon. He was flying over it, floating. He was alone, but not afraid. A pair of giants crouched in the distance. He flew between them, passing through the teeth of a dragon. Then he was in a long tunnel. A red glow throbbed all about him. The heat was incredible. His skin crackled like dry paper. Each breath burned his lungs. Suddenly, he was standing beside a bubbling lake, and the heat was much, much worse. He stared at the fiery surface.
"Michael! Michael! Wake up!"
Emma was shaking him. He opened his eyes and had no idea where he was. Then he recognized the interior of the plane, saw Gabriel moving about, getting their things together, and he remembered.
"Are you all right?" Emma asked. "You were making noise."
"What did I say?"
"Not so much words, more like..." "Oh, get ready. Gabriel says we're landing soon. And Michael?"
"What?"
"He says we might see penguins."
Michael rubbed his eyes and looked out the window. In the dim pre-dawn, ghostly white cliffs rose up before them. Michael watched as an enormous ice shelf cleaved off the cliff and collapsed almost gently into the sea. Then the plane passed over the wall of ice, and there was nothing but whiteness below them and before them.
"I brought us here," Michael thought. "Whatever happens is my fault."
He set about pulling on his boots.
"There, look! Don't scare him.
The penguin waddled toward them, flat wings held out wide to balance its wobbly bowling pin body. The penguin came to just past their knees, and its webbed feet went... on the hard-packed ice and snow. Michael and Emma stood perfectly still as the bird manoeuvred by them and disappeared around a building.
"That's the best thing I ever saw," Emma said. "Ever!"
It was 9 in the morning, and the sun had yet to rise. The temperature was only 10 degrees below freezing, which was apparently quite warm. The plane, whose pontoons doubled as skis, had landed on a runway of compacted snow beside the outpost. The outpost itself seemed like something you might find on the moon. 9 or 10 low metal buildings, domed roofs studded with antennas, half-buried tunnels snaking here and there. It looked like a space station, Michael thought, or a giant hamster run. Gabriel had made the children wait in the plane till he returned with new cold-weather gear and their own clothes, which he'd run through the dryer at the outpost laundry. It was fortunate that Dr. Pym had given them warm clothes before going to Malpessa, since the outpost store did not cater to children. Gabriel had simply bought the smallest sizes he could find, and Michael and Emma both got long underwear, heavy parkas with fur-lined hoods, insulated snow pants to go over their normal pants, thickly padded mittens, liners to go inside the mittens, face masks, hats, goggles, and shell-like boots that fit over their old boots.
"Like boots for our boots," Emma said. "Cool."
Michael's parka and pants just about fit him, but Gabriel had to cut some length off the sleeves of Emma's parka and the bottoms of her pants, the edges of which he then sealed with heavy tape. When both children were finally dressed, Michael felt as if he were embarking on an undersea expedition or a journey into deep space. Emma looked at him and giggled.
"You look like Mr. Sausage. So, you're dressed the same."
Then she tried to punch him, lost her balance, and fell over. Even dressed as they were, when they stepped out of the plane, Michael's breath was ripped away by the cold. It was a kind of cold that the children had never experienced, and they stood there taking short breaths, getting used to the cramped feeling in their lungs. It was then they saw the penguin, whom Emma immediately named Derek. And this put them in a good mood as they headed to the outpost cafe to join Gabriel for breakfast. The windows of the metal hut were steamed with heat, and the floor was a steel grating through which the snow that people trampled inside could melt away. There were a dozen tables, perhaps half of them full. Gabriel and the small pilot sat in the corner. Gabriel got the children trays and plates and let them place their orders. Scrambled eggs, pancakes, bacon, toast, hash browns, with the man at the grill. As Michael pressed the button to fill his hot chocolate, he noticed the stares he and Emma were getting. Gabriel had told them that the outpost was a way station for scientists, oil workers, explorers, and traders from all over Antarctica, but that children here were rare.
"We'll leave as soon as we've eaten and the plane is refueled. The fewer questions asked, the better."
At the table, Gabriel and the pilot had laid out a large map of Antarctica.
"Now," Gabriel said to Michael, "as long as the weather holds, Gustavo will fly us wherever we want, but you must tell us where to go."
"It's not easy," Michael said. "It's all in pieces in my mind. But the next thing we're looking for should be a pair of mountains. They're really tall and thin. There are other mountains around them, but they're the biggest, and they're right next to each other. Does that make sense?"
As Gabriel spoke to the pilot in Spanish, Michael saw that Emma had already eaten both of her pancakes and was half finished with her eggs. He knew he'd better hurry, or she'd start in on his breakfast. The pilot was saying something to Gabriel and pointing to a spot on the map. Michael could see a shaded area which he knew indicated mountains.
"He says," Gabriel interpreted, "you mean the horns, A pair of mountains at the head of the Victoria Range. It is perhaps 2 hours flying from here. What do we do when we get there?
There should be a cave between the two mountains, Michael said as he chewed through 3 pieces of bacon. And there are these rock formations in front of the cave that make it look like a mouth with huge teeth. The dead man called it the Dragon's Mouth. He must have called it that in his own language, but somehow I know that's the name.
Gabriel spoke to the pilot, and the pilot replied and shook his head.
He knows of no such cave, but that means nothing. What then?
Then,
Michael said, fending off Emma's fork, which was stabbing at one of his pancakes,
there's, like, a gap in the memory. I told you it was all in pieces, but on the other side of the cave we should find a volcano. That's where the chronicle is hidden.
Again, Gabriel spoke to the man. Again, the man said something and shook his head. Then the pilot rolled up his map and walked out.
He says, Gabriel told the children, that there is no volcano in that region, and that this would be a thing he knows since he has flown all over this area. But he will fly us to the base of the horns, and we will see if we can find the cave. We must hope the weather holds.
There is a volcano,
Michael said, surprised at his own stubbornness.
I know there is.
Gabriel nodded.
I believe you, but I am worried about this cave. These memories you inherited are more than 200 years old. In that time there could have been landslides, earthquakes. The cave could be hidden or collapsed. Either way, we shall see. Now, eat. The sun will soon be up.
I'm getting seconds, Emma said, since Mr. Sausage here won't share.
And she picked up her syrup-smeared plate and carried it to the grill. Soon they were in the air. The sun had finally risen over the horizon, and as they flew, Emma kept jumping from one side of the plane to the other, pressing her face against the windows. The night before, she'd been too tired and upset to appreciate her first ever plane ride. Today, she was fed and rested. Though really, Michael knew, the change in her mood was due to Gabriel. After breakfast, in the tunnel-like corridor outside the cafe, Michael had heard him whisper,
"I won't leave you again."
And Emma had leaped up and thrown her arms around his neck. Since then, she had been more and more her old self. And now, with the sun shining in the distance and a beautiful, strange land passing below, she was clearly enjoying the moment. He was not quite so carefree. The certainty he'd felt in the cafe had given way to doubt. What if the pilot was right and there was no volcano, or there was, but the Guardian was sending them into a trap? Michael only had a few of the dead man's memories. He didn't truly know the man's mind. He could be leading Emma and Gabriel to their deaths. He wanted to mention this to Gabriel to let the man assuage his fears, but he was terrified of appearing less than completely confident. He couldn't come across as weak.
"Michael!" Emma cried. "Come quick!"
He joined her at the side of the plane.
"Look!"
She pointed to the ground far below.
"It's Derek!"
Michael could just make out a small, dark shape moving across the white expanse.
"Are you sure that's him?" "Oh, that's definitely Derek! I'd recognize him anywhere."
She pressed her forehead against the window, peering down.
"I wonder where he's going."
Michael felt a hand on his shoulder. It was Gabriel, and he motioned them to the cockpit. Michael and Emma crowded in behind the pilot, who grinned and pointed through the window. Emma let out a low gasp. Directly before them was a range of enormous mountains, white peaks rising from a white plain. The mountains were wide-waisted and packed in tight, one against the other, but 2 peaks stood out. They were the furthest forward and the tallest and the thinnest. There was no mistaking them. The horns, Michael thought. He experienced a moment of intense déjà vu, for though he was seeing them for the first time, he knew the mountains from the dead man's memory. Michael found it unsettling,
as if his sense of who he was, the things he knew, the things he remembered, the things that made him him, had begun to blur at the edges.
"These are the mountains?" Gabriel asked.
"Yes." His voice was barely audible over the whine of the engine. The pilot then spoke to Gabriel, who nodded and turned to the children.
"We will be there in 20 minutes. He will land a few miles from the base of the horns. From there we will go on foot. It is time to get ready."
Michael's hands shook as he tried to zip up the front of his parka, and he turned so no one would notice. Soon both children were muffled in parkas, hats, face masks, goggles, mittens. All that remained were the hard outer boots that Gabriel had bought at the outpost. The children were too stiffly dressed to bend over, so Gabriel had them lie on the floor while he stuffed their old boots into the new ones and snapped them shut. Then he checked to make sure all their gear was zipped and cinched properly. Michael could scarcely move, and he wondered how in the world they were supposed to hike for 3 miles. The plane bumped and rocked as they glided lower. Clinging to a strap on the wall, Michael watched as Gabriel went over the contents of a large pack, double-checking that he had food, water, an emergency shelter, ropes, an ice axe, and other necessary gear. He also, Michael saw, strapped a slender, 3-foot-long, canvas-wrapped object to the pack. Michael knew it was Gabriel's falchion, the machete-like weapon the children had seen him use while fighting in Cambridge Falls. It reminded Michael, as if he needed reminding, that they had no idea what lay ahead. The plane skipped across the ground, and Michael and Emma lost their grips on the wall straps and flew forward, crashing into the bulkhead, though their many layers kept them from getting hurt. Twice more the plane struck the ground and rebounded into the air, for while the snow was hard, it undulated like a frozen sea. Finally, the plane settled, wobbled unevenly for 100 yards, and came to a halt. Michael looked at his sister.
"Are you okay?"
"I'm hot," Emma grumbled.
"I wish they'd open the door." "I know what you meant. I'm just hot."
Gabriel checked their clothing one last time.
"We have 4 more hours of daylight. If we find this cave, the Dragon's Mouth, we will continue on. Failing that, we will either return to the plane or camp if we can find shelter. Gustavo will wait until midnight, then fly back to the outpost. He will come here every day for 3 days and wait for us during daylight hours. Are you ready?"
Michael saw that Gabriel was looking at him, waiting for an answer, and it crossed his mind to say,
"You know, now that I've had time to sit with it, I think we should scuttle the whole thing."
But he knew that wasn't what Gabriel was asking. Their way led onward, not back, and in asking if he was ready, Gabriel was merely letting Michael make the decision to begin. Michael reached up to straighten his glasses, realized he was wearing goggles, and straightened them instead.
"Yes, let's go."
Gabriel opened the door, and it was as if all the cold air in the world swept into the plane. Gabriel carried his pack out first, then helped Emma to the ground. Michael saw the pilot, Gustavo, watching them with a worried expression.
"Thank you for the ride,"
Michael said, his voice muffled by the mask.
"We'll see you soon, I hope."
And he followed Emma out into the cold. The ground had a hard, icy crust, which allowed them to walk without snowshoes. The horns loomed above them, outlined against a blue sky, their crooked peaks bending in toward each other. Gabriel led, with Emma in the middle and Michael bringing up the rear. Looking back, Michael could see the pale disk of the sun hanging above the rim of the earth. More than ever, he felt like a voyager on some distant planet. With the extra weight of the clothes and the boots, walking was hard work, and Michael's legs soon grew heavy. His watch was buried under multiple layers, and the only landmarks he had to gauge their progress by were the mountains before them, which seemed to grow no closer, and the plain behind them, which somewhat distressingly became smaller and smaller.
They had been walking, Michael guessed, for half an hour, when Gabriel stopped and turned, staring past the children.
"What is it?"
Michael could see nothing except the plane, tiny and dark, in the distance.
"I am not sure."
Gabriel knelt and took a rope and set of metal clips from his pack. He ran the rope between the clips and fastened the clips to his, Michael's and Emma's jackets, linking them together.
"What's this for?"
Emma asked.
"Safety."
They kept walking. The ground rose. Michael was cold now, even though it seemed impossible that a person could be cold while wearing so many layers. To distract himself, he thought about the library in the house in Cambridge Falls, and how much he wished he was sitting beside the fire with a cup of hot chocolate and the dwarf omnibus open in his lap, watching the snow fall outside, maybe eating a grilled cheese. And he was thinking this, and thinking how much nicer it was to read about adventures than to actually have them, when he noticed how faint his shadow had become. All the time they'd been walking, his shadow had stretched before him, sharp and black against the white ground, but now it was barely visible. He turned and saw that the sun had disappeared. But that made no sense. There were still several hours of daylight left. Then he realized that he could no longer see the plane either. He began to have an uneasy feeling in his stomach.
"Gabriel!"
That was all he managed before the storm hit. It was like a wave crashing over him, knocking him into Emma. Sprawled upon the snow, the children were blown helplessly forward. Michael scrambled for something to cling to, but his hands found no purchase. He saw the two of them being blown like leaves before a hurricane to the other side of Antarctica. Then, with a jerk, they stopped. Gabriel had dug his boots into the ice, planted his axe, and wrapped his arm around the rope, tying them all together. Like a fisherman reeling in his catch, he drew the children toward him, angling his back to take the brunt of the wind. Michael and Emma huddled into the small eddy of his body. The howling filled their ears. Visibility was an arm's length or less. "A whiteout," Michael thought, having read the words somewhere. "We're in a whiteout." Emma yelled something, but her words were swept away. Gabriel leaned forward, shouting over the wind.
"I will set up our shelter. It is useless trying to return to the plane. We would become lost. We must wait out the storm."
"But we're so close," Michael shouted. "If we get to the cave, we'll be safe."
"We'll never find it. Even the mountains have disappeared."
"I can find it."
The words surprised Michael. He hadn't thought them or planned on saying them, but he knew that what he'd said was true. All the time they'd been walking, some invisible force had been pulling him forward. He was only fully aware of it now that they'd stopped. But he knew that if he let himself be led, he would find the cave.
"What's going on?"
Emma turned from Michael to Gabriel.
"I can't hear anything."
Gabriel was staring at him, his eyes hidden behind dark, frost-covered goggles.
"Are you sure? It is a risk."
"He means we could all die," Michael thought, "become hopelessly lost, stumble into a crevasse. Setting up camp was the only sensible, practical thing to do." He looked at Emma, swiveling her head between him and Gabriel, saying,
"Huh? What do you say? It's so loud. Huh?"
It wasn't fair. Michael would risk his own life willingly. Why did he also have to risk his sister's, or Gabriel's?
"You must decide,"
Gabriel shouted. Michael closed his eyes. The tug was still there, like an invisible hook attached to his chest. He knew it was the Chronicle.
"Yes, I can find it."
"Find what?"
Emma shouted.
"What are you two talking about?"
Gabriel didn't answer, but set about switching the rope so that Michael was leading.
"We'll follow you."
He handed Michael his ice axe, and Michael stood and started off through the storm.
He had to brace himself at every step to keep from being blown over, and it was incredibly tiring, walking forward while pushing back with all his strength. With the gusting of the wind, there were brief moments when things would clear, and Michael could see 10 or even 15 feet ahead, but most times he waved his hand before his face and saw nothing. "Please," he kept thinking, "please don't let me be wrong." But he could feel the Chronicle out there calling to him more and more strongly with each step. He found himself thinking of a field trip that he and his sisters and a bunch of other kids had taken to a farm a few years before. They'd been out in the middle of nowhere, and the driver of the van, a sulky teenager, had scoured the radio for any station that, as he put it, didn't play banjo music. Finally, he'd found one. It had been scratchy and faint at first, but as they drove on and presumably got nearer to the source, the signal had become more and more clear. Michael felt that way now, as if he'd finally gotten close enough to hear the music. "Michael!" Emma had shouted in his ear and was grabbing his shoulder and pointing. Michael looked up. He'd been staring at the ground, focusing on not leading everyone into a chasm, and there, 10 feet away, just visible through the whirling snow, past 3 pillars covered in snow and ice, pillars that tapered as they rose to give a very credible impression of fangs, was the dark, gaping maw of a cave. Moments later, they were inside the cave, stamping their feet, beating the caked-up snow and ice from their bodies, brushing the crystals off their fur-lined hoods as the storm raged outside. Gabriel clapped Michael on the shoulder. "Well done!" Michael tried to shrug, but the gesture was lost inside the enormous parka. "Oh, you know, it was no big deal." "Yeah," Emma said, "you're probably right."
"Well," Michael said, irked, "it was kind of a big deal."
Then Emma laughed and clapped her mittens together, or tried to. She couldn't quite make her hands meet while wearing the parka, and told Michael that of course it was a big deal, and if King Robbie were there, he'd probably give Michael 12 more dwarf medals. "Ha ha," Michael said, though he couldn't help thinking a medal wouldn't be uncalled for.
"Are you still cold?" Emma asked. "You're shaking."
In fact, Michael was trembling, but it had nothing to do with the cold. In trusting his instinct, he should have been filled with confidence. But the opposite had happened. He didn't understand how it had worked, how he'd succeeded. He felt out of control, and the feeling scared him. He'd gotten very lucky, and he mustn't count on it happening again.
"I just need to start moving."
"Then let us."
Gabriel had taken 3 flashlights from his pack, and he handed one to each of the children.
"You're the leader. Lead."
Michael looked at Emma, who shrugged and said,
"Just don't get us killed."
And with that, Michael turned, and they set off into the cave. The cave was different from all the other caves and tunnels the children had explored in one major respect. It was covered in ice. Floor, ceiling, and walls were glazed in a hard blue-white shell. Luckily, the new boots Gabriel had brought them had rough soles that gripped the slick surface. Still, they proceeded slowly, and their flashlights kept reflecting back at them, making the children's hearts beat faster as they imagined beasts with glowing eyes peering at them from the darkness. Soon, the sound of the storm had faded, and the tunnel opened into a vast cavern, and they walked along a narrow track that hugged the wall. They shone their lights into the abyss, illuminating a lake of black ice, and Michael peered down and saw things with claws and teeth and wings held in a frozen sleep. The tunnel resumed on the far side of the lake, and the ice on the walls began to give way to bare rock, till there were only patches of ice here and there, and then finally none at all. Michael found himself pulling down his mask, pushing back his hood, unzipping his jacket. Then he snapped off his flashlight.
"Michael,"
Emma whispered.
"I know."
The end of the tunnel was before them, and light poured through it.
not the dim greyish haze of a snowstorm, but sunlight, golden, warm, bright sunlight. Only that wasn't possible. Michael knew that wasn't possible. And then,
"Michael, can you hear?"
"Yes."
It was the sound of a bird singing. Chapter 10. The End of the World.
"Did you know?"
"No."
"None of this?"
"No."
"Because it's... wow."
Yes, Michael thought. Wow. They had come out of the tunnel and were high above an enormous crescent-shaped valley. From where they stood, sheer rock walls dropped down nearly a mile to the valley floor, while snow-capped mountains rose above them, encircling the valley in an unbroken ring. Michael guessed it was at least a mile to the other side. To both the left and the right, the valley curved away and out of sight. The sky was a pure crystalline blue, and the air was warm and still. Far below, the valley floor looked to be covered in a dark canopy of green. Michael thought of taking a Polaroid, then decided a photo wouldn't do the view justice.
"But we're at the South Pole," Emma said. "There should be penguins and snow and polar bears."
"Polar bears are at the North Pole."
"You know what I mean. This is..."
"It's the Chronicle," Michael said.
"Thousands of years ago, I bet this was just like the rest of Antarctica. Then the Order brought the Chronicle here, and everything changed."
They were silent, staring down at the impossibly lush valley. Then Gabriel said,
"There."
He was pointing to the right, past the bend of the valley, just visible over the shoulder of a mountain. A thin trail of black smoke rose into the air.
"The volcano," Michael whispered. "Amazing," Emma marveled. "You were actually right."
"You don't have to act so surprised," Michael said.
"But I am," Emma said. "I'm really surprised."
Quickly, for they were already hot and sweating, the trio removed their cold weather gear, their parkas, heavy boots, insulated pants, long underwear, goggles, mittens and hats, and Gabriel stowed everything inside the cave for their return journey. Michael was surprised to find the grey-blue marble hanging from a strap around his neck, and realized that in the excitement of the last 24 hours he'd forgotten all about it. Obviously, now was not the time to ponder who had sent it or what its purpose might be, but as he tucked the glass orb back inside his shirt, Michael promised himself he would try to figure it out the moment he got the chance. The tunnel had given onto a promontory, from which a set of nearly vertical stairs cut into the face of the cliff wound down to the valley floor. Gabriel took the safety rope and clipped it to the children's belts.
"We'll get to the bottom," he said, "then make for the volcano."
The stairs were more like a ladder than a staircase, with every step nearly 2 feet high. Only once did Michael peer over the side to check their progress, and he found it was a straight drop to the bottom. After that, he kept his attention on each individual step. The further they descended, the warmer and more humid it became. Michael's glasses kept slipping down his nose, and his T-shirt stuck to his back. Bird calls echoed through the valley, and soon they could hear the sound of running water. They stopped halfway down, and Gabriel gave them bread, hard sausage, and dried fruit from his pack. Michael was checking his watch, thinking that the sun should have set, and yet it was still light, when they heard something that was not a bird. The cry came from the direction of the volcano. It was harsh and savage, and silenced everything in the valley.
"What was that?"
Emma whispered. Gabriel shook his head.
"I do not know."
Neither did Michael, but he did know that whatever had made the sound was very, very big. They finished their meal in silence and resumed the descent. 30 minutes later, they reached the canopy of trees. From above, Michael had expected to find a tropical jungle, but the valley floor was covered by a forest of enormous redwoods. He recognized the trees from photos and movies, but these were taller and larger than any he had ever seen. Indeed, the valley floor turned out to be much lower than they had thought, for even after reaching the canopy, they kept climbing down and down and down.
"Can you believe," Emma said when they were finally at the bottom, "we have to go back up that?"
The light had now begun to fade, and it was darker still under the canopy.
"I know you're tired," Gabriel said, "but we should push on. I would like to camp closer to the volcano so we can arrive there tomorrow morning."
Michael nodded. Emma groaned, and they kept walking, no one mentioning that the creature's cry had come from the direction of the volcano. Michael felt as if they were walking through a forest of sleeping giants. Even Gabriel stared up in awe at the massive red-brown trunks, but the going was slow, as the forest floor was covered in a thick bed of ferns, and Gabriel had to use his falchion to bushwhack a path. Little else moved in the forest. The birds kept to the canopy, and the only other wildlife were shiny black beetles that scuttled up the sides of the great trees and, with a furious whirring and clicking, abruptly took flight, weaving away between the trunks. The beetles were the size of turtles, and after Michael was struck in the back of the head and literally knocked off his feet, the children learned to duck when they heard one coming. Still, Michael thought, fingering the sore spot behind his ear, if this is all there is, birds and beetles, why do I feel like we're being watched? As they hiked, the sound of rushing water grew louder, and eventually they came to a river, perhaps 40 yards across, running clear and swift down the center of the canyon. They were hot from the walk, and Gabriel let them lie on their stomachs and dip their faces in the stream. The water was ice-cold, and they drank until their teeth ached. Refreshed, the small party continued on, following the bank of the river until it was too dark to see, and both children were dragging their feet, and Emma had said for the 15th time, "This looks like a good place to stop." Gabriel made camp on a large rock that gave views both upstream and downstream, and he brought out food, more bread, sausage, and dried fruit, and said they would not risk a fire. Michael wondered if Gabriel also felt they were being watched. If the man did, he said nothing. After they had eaten, Gabriel cut fronds from nearby ferns and made a thick, soft bed on the rock, and Emma lay down and was asleep in a moment.
"Sleep," Gabriel told Michael. "I'll stand watch."
Michael fully intended to tell Gabriel to wake him in a few hours and let him stand his turn, but exhausted and aching in every part of his body and lulled by the murmur of the river, Michael lay down beside his sister and slept. Michael dreamed. Again, he was in the long, dark tunnel, walking toward the red glow. Again, he stood before the lake of fire, staring into the surface as his eyes burned and the heat stifled his breath. He knew the Chronicle was somewhere nearby, but where? And then, strangely, he heard music. It seemed to be all around him. The heat lessened. He could breathe without pain. A weight lifted from his shoulders. He felt as light as air, as if he could float up into the sky and sail away. A hand on his shoulder jostled him awake. It was still dark. Gabriel was leaning over him, a finger to his lips, telling Michael to remain silent. There was music drifting out of the forest, and Michael recognized it as the music from his dream. He sat up. Indeed, he might have leaped up had Gabriel's hand not rested on his shoulder.
"I heard. Yes, it began a minute ago. I am going to investigate. Stay with your sister."
Gabriel rose, then paused.
"You will stay with her?"
There was a question in his voice.
"Of course, yes. I'll stay with her."
The man stared at him.
Michael couldn't help himself. Just the music. It's so beautiful.
Try not to listen.
Okay.
Gabriel kept staring at him. Michael realized he was humming. He stopped. Gabriel said,
I will be back soon.
And, unsheathing his falchion, he slipped noiselessly into the trees. Michael glanced at his sister. Emma was smiling in her sleep. Michael had never seen Emma smile in her sleep. Usually she slept with her hands clenched into fists as if she were fighting battles in her dreams. He wondered if she could hear the music. It really was so beautiful. No, Gabriel had told him not to listen. Taking off his glasses, Michael lay down on the rock and splashed ice-cold water on his face. He was instantly wide awake.
That's better,
he thought. Then he realized the reason it was better was because he could hear the music more clearly. He stood, water dripping from his face, and looked about the starlit darkness. Everything around him, the air, the water, the earth, the rocks, all seemed to be responding to the song. But Gabriel had said not to listen. Well, Michael thought, Gabriel was a wonderful fellow and knew about a great many useful things, but music was obviously not one of them. There could be nothing dangerous about such a song. It was a song about the air and the water, about the trees and the birds, about those giant beetles that flew without looking where they were going. It was a song about life, and it was asking you to join it. To dance. Michael began swaying back and forth, his right hand ghost conducting in the air. And I love dancing, Michael thought, even though he'd never danced once in his entire life and had always taken great pains to avoid it. He shook Emma awake. She moaned and kept her eyes shut.
Stop it. Emma, wake up.
But I was dreaming, and there was... She fell silent. Michael saw she'd heard the music.
It's real. I know.
Michael was bursting with happiness. He'd had the most wonderful idea. He told Gabriel he wouldn't leave Emma, but what if he brought her along to search for the music?
Come on, we gotta find it.
And he seized Emma by the hand and dragged her into the forest. The music was coming from further along in the direction of the volcano. Strangely, the ferns that had fought their passage all day now seemed to give way before the children, bending back to open a path.
"Where's Gabriel?" Emma panted. "He went to look for the music. You think we'll find him?"
Maybe. If not, we can look for him while we're dancing.
Yay!
Cried Emma, who generally disliked dancing at least as much as Michael did.
And then Gabriel can dance with us.
Ah, he's probably there dancing already,
Michael laughed. And then, quite suddenly, they arrived. It was a large circular clearing ringed by great trees. The ferns stopped at the edge of the clearing, and the ground beyond was covered by low, thick grass. Across the clearing, Michael could see figures with torches emerging from the trees. They were too far away to see well, but Michael knew that they were the ones making the music. And it was then he realized that the music was singing, that voices were making those beautiful sounds. Emma let out a small cry and leaped forward, but Michael yanked her back.
"What are you doing?
I just had an awful thought."
They were crouched beside one of the trees at the edge of the clearing. Michael tried to sound as grave as possible. He needed Emma to understand the seriousness of what he was about to say.
"What if we're not wearing the right clothes? I don't want to look stupid."
Emma stared at him, then nodded.
"That's really good thinking."
"I know,"
Michael said, and he cursed himself for not making Gabriel carry a set of fancier clothes in his pack. He should have known something like this would happen. The figures were moving toward the center of the clearing, and as they drew closer, the torches shone on their faces. The children stared in wonder.
"Michael, are those?"
"Yes."
"Really? I mean, really and truly?"
"Yes."
His voice was dry as a stone, but he managed to say,
"Those are elves."
There were perhaps 40 of them. Some were carrying torches, others had lanterns. All of them were singing, and while not exactly dancing, the very way they walked, even their smallest gesture, was more graceful than any dance. And every one of them, Michael's heart sank as he realized this, was dressed incredibly well. What Michael thought of as the girl elves wore long white and cream dresses of frilly material, while the boy elves wore white trousers and shirts, along with pink and white, blue and white, or green and white striped jackets. The boy elves wore stiff-brimmed straw hats. The girl elves twirled parasols on their dainty shoulders. A few of the elves carried wooden tennis rackets. Michael recognized the clothes as the fashions of 100 years ago, and the logical part of his brain, which was still functioning, albeit at a very low level, reminded him that it had been 100 years ago that the magical world had gone into hiding. The elves, it seemed, had simply kept up the trends of that time. And right they were, Michael thought. They looked marvellous.
"Their clothes are so beautiful."
Emma was on the verge of tears.
"We'll never find clothes like that."
"Shh," Michael said. "I want to hear."
For the elves had all gathered in the center of the clearing, and they abruptly shifted from the ethereal, wordless song that Michael and Emma had heard in their dreams to a new song, one with a jaunty, let's-all-go-boating sort of tune. And this time, Michael could make out the words.
"Oh, she has to eat, she has to eat, she'd better watch her figure. Her shape is long and slender, her nails they cut like ice. Her eyes still shine like diamonds, and yet her stomach rumbles on. Oh, she has to eat, she has to eat, she'd better watch her figure."
"What are they singing about?"
Emma asked.
"I don't know," Michael said. "It's a lovely song, though, don't you think?"
"It is," Emma said. "Very lovely."
And it occurred to Emma that she didn't use the word lovely half as often as she should, and she would definitely correct that. It was a lovely word. Lovely.
"Lovely, lovely, lovely, lovely."
"What are you doing?"
Michael whispered.
"Just saying the word, lovely,"
Emma whispered back.
"Oh,"
Michael said, wondering why he hadn't thought of that.
"Right."
And as they watched the elves and listened to the song, they both murmured,
"Lovely, lovely, 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 lovely."
Some of the elves were doing cartwheels around the clearing. A few played leapfrog, and one was riding around on one of those old-fashioned bicycles with a giant front wheel and a tiny back wheel. Several of the elves had opened wicker picnic baskets and were handing out beverages and food, mostly cake. Two of the elves had begun to set up what looked to Michael like a dunking booth. The whole scene was strangely familiar, and Michael realized where he'd seen such things before, in old movies, when people would have town fairs with bobbing for apples and pie-eating contests, and something involving a greased pig. Just as their clothes were stuck in the past, so too were the elves' traditions. Michael was charmed.
"Lovely," he murmured. "Lovely."
And the song went on.
"Her arms are just so shapely, her waist is slim and fine, her nose knows no equal, ha ha, and her teeth, oh, let them always shine. Oh, she has to eat, she has to eat, she'd better watch her figure."
"Did you know there were elves here?"
Emma whispered.
"No, it's a really nice surprise, though," Michael said.
"It sure is. How's my hair look?"
This was the first time in her life that Emma had asked this question. Michael looked at her. She had not showered since the previous day, when they'd stayed at the cottage in Spain, and since then they'd climbed through a tomb, run through a sewer, jumped into a canal, hiked through a blizzard, which involved the wearing of hats and hoods and much sweating, and slept on a bed of ferns.
"Honestly?"
"Yes."
"It looks like a bum's hair. I'm sorry, but you have bum hair."
"It's okay," Emma said. "You have bum hair, too."
"Look what they've got," Michael exclaimed. "Oh, lucky."
The elves had set up a long wooden vanity with four stations, each one facing a mirror and outfitted with a full complement of brushes, combs, tweezers, clippers, various ointments, tonics, and powders. And the children were filled with such desire for those brushes and tonics and powders that they very nearly rushed into the clearing, and indeed might have, had not the vanity's chairs been instantly filled by girl and boy elves fixing their hair, powdering their cheeks, plucking invisible hairs, though several of them, Michael noticed, just sat gazing at themselves in the mirrors, exclaiming, "You look wonderful! You really do! You look wonderful!"
"We can't go out there like this," Michael said. "I've got scissors on my knife. We'll just cut off all our hair. No hair's better than bum hair, right?"
"Wait," Emma said. "I've got a better idea."
She ran a few feet into the forest and returned with an armful of fern fronds.
"We're going to make fancy hats. Then no one will see our bum hair."
Michael could scarcely believe what amazing ideas Emma was having tonight. First saying lovely over and over, and now the fancy hats idea. They set to work using Michael's pocket knife to cut the fronds into 5- and 6-inch pieces. But they soon hit an obstacle, realizing they had no way of actually attaching the fronds. Then Michael got the idea of scooping up handfuls of moist, mud-like earth from the bases of the trees and using it to coat their heads.
"It'll be like glue. The fronds will just stick to it."
Emma was so pleased that she told Michael he was her favourite brother.
"I'm your only brother," Michael said. "I know. Isn't it great? Now, hurry up. I bet they're going to start dancing any second."
Not wasting any time, the children smeared the mud from just above their eyebrows, over the tops of their heads, all the way down to the base of their necks. Gooey helmets in place, they seized fistfuls of fern fronds and began slapping them, more or less willy-nilly, to any free patch of mud. In a few moments, Michael and Emma had more than 2 dozen floppy green fronds sticking out in all directions from the top, sides, front, and back of their heads.
"How do I look?" Michael asked his sister. "You look great."
"How do I look?"
"You look amazing. You should wear that hat all the time, even when we're not dancing."
"I was just thinking that," Emma said, supremely pleased.
"Are you ready?"
Michael said.
"Am I?
Let's go."
"Hold on."
Michael pulled the blue-grey orb from inside his shirt, so that it lay on his chest like a sort of decorative necklace. He had never been one for jewellery before, but he thought the glass marble gave him a certain flair. He saw Emma's eyes go wide.
"Oh, I want one."
"I'll let you borrow it later. Come on."
And the children were about to plunge into the clearing when the song changed. "We've brought you something special to remind you what you were, for deep below that nasty hide there's a princess hiding still. Please come back, oh please come back, we really, really miss you. Please come back, oh please come back, change your gold band for this one." And the children saw 4 elves emerge from the trees, carrying something on a litter, an object draped in black cloth. The crowd sang louder and louder, and the elves all joined hands, so they were dancing around the litter in a large, skipping circle.
Sensing that something momentous and potentially wonderful was about to happen, the children hesitated at the edge of the trees. The four elves carried their burden to the center of the clearing and set it down. It was not easy to make out what was happening, what with the wavering torchlight and the elves moving around and blocking the view. Then two of the elves whipped away the black cloth, and Michael had a glimpse of something ghostly and white, and there was a flash of gold. The pitch and frenzy of the celebration increased tenfold. The singing filled the entire canyon. The dancing elves whirled about faster and faster, and Michael thought that if he didn't go and dance right that very instant, he would never be happy again.
"Michael!" Emma cried. "We have to..."
"I know, I know." And, with a quick fluffing to ensure their leafy headpieces appeared to best effect, the children jumped up. But they were destined never to join the dance, for just at that moment a cry tore through the valley. It was the same savage, chilling, terrible shriek they had heard while descending the rocky staircase that afternoon. In an instant the singing stopped, the torches went out, and the whole party of elves, along with the dunking booth, the wooden vanity, the picnic baskets, and the giant bicycle with the two different size wheels, vanished. It was dark and silent, and the children stood alone in their fern-frond helmets at the border of the trees. Michael felt a heaviness enter his body. He no longer wanted to sing and dance. Indeed, he remembered he hated dancing. And what did he have on his head? He glanced at Emma, visible in the starlight, and saw a mass of mud and ferns matted into a tangled nest upon her head. A few of the fronds had begun an oozy slide down the side of her face.
"Do I have a bunch of leaves and gunk stuck in my hair?" Emma asked.
"Yeah," Michael said, hoping that what he felt moving over his ear wasn't a bug.
"Do I?" "Yeah."
Wordlessly, the two children pulled off the fronds, wiping away as much as was possible the half-solid mud caking their hair. Neither asked the other how he or she looked.
"Where do all the elves go?" Emma said.
Michael shrugged. He was far too irritated to care. He'd always known that elves were lazy and vain, but it turned out they also sang songs that made you want to dress up and rub mud all over your head and... They were just children, he thought. Just silly, stupid children. Looking out into the clearing, Michael saw that the elves had left behind the ghostly object they'd unloaded from the litter. Suddenly, he had to know what it was.
"Wait here." "What? Michael, no!"
Emma tried to grab him, but Michael was already running in a low crouch across the clearing. Just as he reached the object, another harsh cry echoed down the valley. It was closer than the last. Whatever was making that noise was on the move. But even so, for a long moment, he simply stood there and stared. The object was the figure of an elf girl carved in clear ice. She looked to be about Michael's age, and her crystalline hair tumbled down her back, and she had been carved smiling and laughing. Even though Michael's elf annoyance was at an all-time high, he had to admit that the elf girl was the most beautiful creature he had ever seen. He reached out and ran a finger along the elf girl's arm, and felt the coldness and slickness of ice starting to melt. A thin gold band, almost like a crown, had been placed on her head. Very carefully, Michael lifted it off. The ice girl was so lifelike that Michael half expected her to protest. She didn't, of course, and Michael, glancing down at the circlet, saw it was actually dozens of fine gold bands all woven together. But what did it all mean? And who was she? Michael was woken out of his reverie by another of the awful shrieks. It was closer than ever. The thing was coming, and coming quickly.
"Michael!"
Emma was running toward him across the clearing.
Without thinking, he slipped the golden circlet into his bag, and he had just started to yell at Emma to go back when there was a shout, and Michael turned and saw Gabriel charging out of the trees from the other direction. "Get down!" the man shouted. "Down!" Then there was another cry, this time from almost directly overhead, and before Michael could look up, he was pushed roughly to the ground. "Stay down!" Gabriel commanded. Emma was still calling her brother's name, and Michael, flat on his stomach, heard the sound of wing beats, and, looking past Gabriel, he watched as the monster swooped down out of the night sky and plucked his sister into the air. Chapter 11 The Snowball Fight.
"Hey, wake up! Come on, wake up!"
The small girl named Abigail, the one who'd helped her find clothes, was leaning over Kate and shaking her.
"I'm awake," Kate said groggily.
All around her, throughout the old church, the day was starting. Children were making their beds, lighting fires in stoves, sweeping the stone floor. The air was so cold that Kate could see her breath before her.
"Guess what just happened?"
Abigail said.
"It started snowing,"
Kate yawned. She reached under her pillow where she'd placed her mother's locket the night before and slipped it into her pocket.
"No, well, yeah, it's been snowing all night, but not that. Rafe was just here."
The girl was barely able to control her excitement.
"And he said, seeing as tonight's New Year's Eve and the big separation and all, Miss Burke wants to have a party."
"Oh?" Kate glanced around. The boy Rafe was nowhere to be seen.
"Last time we had a party, Scruggs did fireworks. This